From prestige to humiliation, Uganda, Ethiopia in the age of Trump. I had arrived late to Ethiopia. When I first visited it in 2012, barely managing to see the Ethiopia that had largely survived for decades, the Ethiopia of lattice work balconies, of later taxis, family pizzerias and piazzas, also the Ethiopia of red terror squares and state surveillance carried out on such a scale you did not buy a new shirt without the president potentially hearing of it. That was late 2012, 3 months following the death of Meles Zenawi. Within a few months, as if making up for lost time, that Ethiopia started to disappear. Toyota Corolla started replacing Ladas. In moved chic smartphones, the graders, the skyscrapers. A sleek metro train appeared. Meskel Square, once the regional representative of Moscow's Red Square, Beijing's Tiananmen, and Pyongyang's Kim Tu-sung Square, was rapidly torn up. The Chinese-built light rail train cut the square to bits, a symbolic adieu to the long-dead Dutch years and perhaps a shamefaced admission that Karl Marx and T-72 tanks had been over the top. In a country of dramatic turning points, the death of Zenawi was a swift dramatic turning point. For months after, Ethiopians still spoke of Zenawi in the present tense, as Zenawi says, as if some fictional medieval Japanese shogun, Zenawi had phoned death to test loyalty. With Zenawi, you exercised caution. However, reprieve from the Mengistu Zenawi continuum to the new changes under Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn failed to break the symbolic barrier, to be authentic. The last time I was in Ethiopia, in September 2016, I did not go into Addis. I was transiting through Bole, a full year since I had last been there. And yet, I sensed that things had reverted to vintage Ethiopia. Fear and gloom had returned. Ethiopians can be a passionate lot, forming sudden and deep friendships, but also quick to the bite. Wearing your heart on your sleeve is as Ethiopian as tanking a globule of Tej. I had noticed the friendly, if guarded manner of the Ethiopian waiter and waitress. But on that day in late September, they were rude to customers and supervisors alike. The increasing personal identification with the state of the nation, as the years since colonialism gathered pace and our ethnic character and idiosyncrasies receded in the rear view and we became nationals, means you sense what's in a country on people's faces. Before Emperor Haile Selassie was overthrown, the concept of nation would have been alien to the vast majority of Ethiopians, to whom government meant landlord. But the 1974 revolution changed that, and so I sensed a mood hard and unhappy had descended. Like a replay of the 70s and 80s, I looked out of the terminal building and knew that out there, beyond the provisional internationalism of airports, the state was killing someone. As they might say in America, the 1970s had called to reclaim our souls. Ethiopians knew what was coming. Barely a week after that transit, a state of emergency had been declared. I was not looking forward to flying back to Entebbe. I did not know if, on my way to Kampala, I would find the highway blocked off and would have to drive through potato gardens and cattle trucks, as had become the norm following the elections in February 2016. What had once taken 1 hour had, in fraught months, become an ordeal stretching 3 hours, driving the 42 kilometers from Entebbe to Kampala. The state feared protests and worse, and through that evil genius unique to tyrannies, it had burned the people. Before the year was out, state forces were to storm a royal palace, kill over 100 people, and deny that famine was looming. Uganda in 2016 felt a bit like Ethiopia circa 1974. Ethiopia in 2016 once again felt like Ethiopia proper, the revanche state back in vintage form. It arrived as a thunderbolt. It transformed Desalegn's face of bonhomie, his smiley icon face, into something more sinister than even Zenawi's unsmiling picture. It was inevitably denied by the government. But Amnesty International's figure of 800 killed by the state since the Oromia uprising of late 2015 would, if true, and there is a compelling reason to believe it is, put some shade on the region. Bar Syria, Afghanistan and Iraq, there are fewer and fewer places in the world where that many can so systematically be killed. In closing the highways to human traffic, killing 100 people in Kasese, Western Uganda, and in suppressing Oromo protests, both governments, confronted by contestations of legitimacy, used the excuse of war on terror to impose heavy-handed security measures. These acts of impunity are also tellingly the reason both Uganda and Ethiopia have hitherto been the USA's staunchest regional allies in the war on terror. As client states, the two delivered their geopolitical goods. It is harder for states like South Africa or Kenya to kill even 8 people or force motorists into village paths without triggering a constitutional crisis. Dictatorships, American diplomats know only too well, make for great allies. And therein lies the naked fact of American democracy and power, and the shame of Ugandans and Ethiopians. But no one wins the status of American ally by just sitting around doing nothing. As Italians make the best pastas, the Japanese great sashimi, so Ethiopians and Ugandans make the best collapsed states in Eastern Africa. Rwandese and Somalis and Sudanese create massive state collapse, but they do so for internal consumption. They collapse only their own states. Ugandans have left their fingerprints on political ruins from Kinshasa to Kigali and Juba. Ethiopians in Asmara and Mogadishu, and who knows where else. Washington notices these differences. But today, what was until a few weeks ago a matter of pride, the privilege of being America's best and closest, has become a matter of panic. From back in the years when the Bill Clinton administration wooed these regimes, belonging in the American camp had brought with it some predictability, and no small amount of kudos. No matter the ideological gap between an Obama and a Bush, you could tell in advance what Washington would do. The bastion of democracy had also had checks and balances that cushioned the relationships against a too precipitate Bush or a recalcitrant Obama. If Bush cut off family planning aid money, at least he put it into HIV/AIDS. He might not believe in the things you believed in, but you could let your 5-year-old daughter listen to him describe his belief. Linebacking America has gone from prestige to humiliating. Now everyone knows you're in it for the money. The fig leaf of progressive, liberal, forward-looking cover cannot be convincing when the original item has gone back to 1860 AD. A president, and prime minister in this case, stands up to declare pride in the relationship with America. Then there comes that pause as they absorb the very loud minds of their audience thinking in unison, grab them by the balls. It feels like the moment we had always warned about, that alliance with the US was never a good idea. Except something too dangerous, for I told you so, gloating came to pass. Three things. Unpredictability of US power is a frightening prospect. The indignity of taking orders from Donald Trump, let alone being seen to be doing so, must rankle with our puritanical dictators. What to do about the things we gave up in exchange for US largesse? The defenestration of Gaddafi was a blow Museveni has not recovered from. That happened under Obama's watch. It scrambles the brain to think what Trump might plan. One thing is for certain. The search for a less expensive, less volatile foreign policy had pushed Washington to seek regional alliances, thence handing lifelines to governments like the one in Kampala, buying them a decade or two extra in power. Trump's knuckle-duster approach has little need of such subtleties. He will send in tomahawks, and when Tillerson arrives, he will not arrive as alternative to smart bombs. He will come reading the riot act. This must make for sleepless nights in state houses around the place. America might not need our armies as much as they used to. Standing at the AU podium, where all other heads of state and government knew you were Washington's favorite, had added some iron to the voice of our president. Coming to Kampala for regional presidents had some urgency to it. For as the representative of American power on earth, what Museveni had permitted on earth would surely be permitted in Washington. These days it must feel, every time a fellow president covers his mouth behind the order paper, that they are concealing a gleeful smile. But joking aside, the alliance with Washington had come at a cost. We might in future learn more about the war in Congo and what transpired in dark corners of our state house for that war to happen. but knowing the USA would not look the other way, emboldened the Ugandan and Rwandan troops that laid waste to that country. Political development in Uganda itself has been arrested. What was the motivation for conceding change when Washington did not care a whit? Might we have beaten a tenderer path to the Sudanese imbroglio had we cared more for riparian amity than allowed ourselves to be a base against Bashir? Too many what ifs. Ethiopia and Uganda allowed relationships between Christians and Muslims, clanmates divided by foreign religions. It is an unmitigated tragedy, and one which may not have run its full course yet. The judicial process may yet tell us what happened, but the fact that both countries have dozens of Muslim leaders behind bars is testament to decades of wrong turns in policy decisions. The tragedy is, what brought us here cannot be placed squarely at the feet of our current leaders. The path to here was long coming, had we known where to look. Shifts and turns in this country since the early 1970s was leading to some place like this. The collapse of the monarchy in Ethiopia and the independence government in Uganda led to a series of other collapses. By the time the 1990s came, when some stability had been won, the armies in both countries had changed structurally and substantively. Economic directions had shifted at least twice in both countries. Banks gone down, industries collapsed. It was easier to pick up Ethiopian and Ugandan economics and militaries for manipulation because they were sissy from the yo-yoing. Such a thing proved less easy with Tanzania or Kenya, where more or less the generals and general managers had risen through the ranks since independence, were running institutions and had over time won legitimacy and had great pride in their professionalism. But these other leaders are sitting there. They can change things. Things will not change for the better. The internal decay is so profound, only worse can follow. It is unlikely America will abandon its East African regional policy. They will only make more humiliating demands, and we will say yes.